Space Cowboy Books presents Simultaneous Times, a science and speculative fiction podcast. Short stories to stir the imagination by contemporary authors.
Little Monsters by Cora Boulard, with music by Red, Blue, Black, Silver. Read by Jean-Paul Garnier. Lana found the monster on the lawn one morning, though she didn't know that it was a monster at first, because it looked like a tangled ball of yarn. But when Lana picked it up, it wasn't soft and fluffy. Instead, it felt rubbery. Lana examined the thing and realized that it was a ball studded with tentacles. Experimentally, Lana threw it into the air and caught it again. Yep, it was a ball. Lana was about to put the strange ball into her school bag, because you can always use a ball, when all of a sudden, the ball moved on its own volition. A slit opened in the side, and suddenly Lana was looking into an eye, a single neon green eye, blinking at her. At that moment, she knew what she'd found was not a ball after all, but a monster. A little bitty baby monster. Monster or not, the creature was obviously small and helpless. After all, it was just a baby and needed someone to take care of it. And since no monster mama showed up to claim her baby, Lana carefully placed the baby monster into her school bag and took it home. She folded a handkerchief, one of the pretty lace-edged ones that Grandma had made for her, and laid it onto the bottom of an old cookie tin to make a nice bed for the monster. Then Lana tucked the monster in, closed the tin, and shoved it under her bed where no one would find it. After all, Mama did not want her to have a pet, and a baby monster probably counted as a pet. So Lana figured it would be best if Mama never learned about the baby monster, because if she didn't know about it, she couldn't get angry. That evening, before she went to bed herself, Lana pulled the cookie tin with the baby monster out from under her bed. She opened the tin to look at the creature, which promptly emitted a pitiful wail. "Oh, I'm sorry," said Lana. "You're hungry, aren't you?" The monster emitted another pitiful wail, which Lana decided to take as a yes. "I'll feed you," Lana said, then paused in doubt. "How do you even eat? I mean, you don't have a mouth." Somehow, a fly had gotten into Lana's bedroom. It buzzed around her nose, and when Lana chased it away, the fly decided to buzz around the monster instead. Lana was about to chase the fly away again, because it was not right to bother the poor little baby monster. But suddenly, one of the monster's tentacles shot out, snatched the fly, and stuffed it into a hitherto unseen hole that appeared to be a mouth. "Oh, so that's how you eat. But don't eat flies." Lana wagged her finger at the creature. "'Cause eating flies is gross. I'll get you something better." Lana dashed to the kitchen to fetch some food. Since she still didn't know what monsters ate, apart from flies, she picked some cornflakes, a handful of popcorn, a few frozen peas, and a piece of chocolate. Then she presented all of those treats to the monster. Immediately, the monster tried to snatch the various foods, its tentacles shooting out of its spherical body at strange angles, much to Lana's delight. It spat out the cornflakes and the popcorn kernels, and the frozen peas caused its tentacles to turn blue, whereupon the monster emitted an even more pitiful wail. On the other hand, it did seem to like the chocolate. So the experiment was a success. Lana knew what to feed her little bitty baby monster, so it would grow big and strong. Though maybe not so big that it didn't fit under the bed anymore and Mama would notice. Next, Lana sang a lullaby to her baby monster, so it would fall asleep. Then she closed the tin and shoved the monster back into its hiding place. At last, Lana went to bed, a big smile on her face. That night, she woke up to a strange beeping sound. At first, she thought it was her alarm clock, her pretty pink alarm clock that looked just like a unicorn. But when she reached for the unicorn clock, she saw that it was only 3 a.m., 4 hours before she was supposed to get up. In the meantime, the beeping stopped, so Lana shrugged and went back to bed. Must have been a dream, she thought. A very strange dream. What Lana did not know was that her monster was one of several that had fallen from the sky that morning. Nor did she know that her little baby monster was not a baby at all, but an advanced scout of the invasion fleet of the alien Sostrorug. None of the advanced scouts fared well. They were run over by cars, trampled by cows, eaten by dogs, and shredded by lawnmowers. One fellow, a scout named Zogmer, was picked up by a young boy and promptly used for baseball practice, which caused the alien to fall into a coma after the first strike and expire of brain damage after the second. One scout, however, got lucky and survived long enough to submit his report to the main fleet waiting in orbit around Earth. This brave scout was called Rosnakath, and he was none other than Lana's monster. His report follows. To Sostrorug Fleet Command, urgent. Warning. Planet 10579 is inhabited, as our probes indicated. But what our probes did not show us is that the inhabitants are giants. I was captured by one of those giants shortly after landing and cruelly imprisoned in a dark cell with impenetrable metal walls. Escape is impossible. The giant attempts to interrogate me and tortures me with the hideous sounds it makes, but I shall remain steadfast. I did find a native creature that is edible and surprisingly tasty, but my giant jailer will not let me have another. Instead, I am fed crumbly, dry, and sticky sweet stuff that is scarcely better than excrement. Comrades, I urgently warn you, do not land on planet 10579. If you value your lives and your freedom, fly onwards and find yourself another planet. And do spare a thought for this poor, tortured prisoner of war on occasion. Rosnakath out. The fleet of Sostrorug took Rosnakath's advice and left Earth's orbit to look for greener pastures. It's not known if they ever found them. But Rosnakath was awarded the Grand Order of Valor in absentia for his heroic sacrifice. Meanwhile, Rosnakath continued to live in Lana's chocolate tin as her beloved monster pet. And after a while, he no longer resented his captivity and began to develop tender feelings towards his giant jailer, a phenomenon that Sostrorug psychologists had dubbed Zargaskov syndrome, after the world where it first had been observed. When the alien prisoners held there eventually came to love their Sostrorug jailers. And so, Rosnakath lived out his days as a pet monster in a cookie tin, and even learned to like cornflakes and chocolate. For a desperate Sostrorug can get used to anything. Sometimes, he even managed to gobble up a fly or two, and Lana no longer tried to stop him. On the contrary, she was happy that the monster kept her bedroom free of insects, even if she still thought that eating flies was gross. And so they lived, happily in the case of Lana, and not so happily in the case of Rosnakath, ever after. Hidden Underneath by Toshiya Kamei, with music by Fog Machine, read by Jean-Paul Garnier. On a muted TV screen, a middle-aged man stood behind a lectern. Flashbulbs splashed white, cold light over his hawk-like face as he spoke. His thin mustache twitched above his lip like a caterpillar. A caption informed viewers that he was the mayor of the upper city. "What's your name, my dear?" A voice jolted me. When I looked up, an elderly man in a soiled white coat stared at me. I blinked against the pale light creeping through the curtains. A pair of dark brown eyes watched me from behind dark-rimmed glasses. His warm gaze put me at ease. No answer came to mind. Through a thick mental fog, I looked around. Dressed in tattered clothes, I was perched on the edge of a workshop desk strewn with cleaning rags, small tools, and machine parts. Next to me, a motionless cyborg arm lay. It was mine. Or it used to be. "Don't worry, my dear," the elderly man said with a reassuring nod. "We can fix you up in no time. Isn't that right, Mr. Jiminy?" He winked at a brown poodle lying at his feet. Mr. Jiminy looked up and let out a soft growl. "Where do you live? What do Mom and Dad do? What are their names?" He showered me with a string of questions, and my mind remained blank. No matter how hard I tried, each question triggered no answer. I shook my head and stared at my hand. My synthetic skin was torn, exposing bright metal underneath. "Are you a doctor?" "Yes, my dear. You're a smart girl. Dr. Gunma at your service." "Where am I?" I tilted my neck to see if it still moved. "This is the best cybernetic clinic in the lower city." He smiled until his eyes disappeared into wrinkles. "How did I get here?" I asked, confused. "Never mind that for now. I'll tell you later." I stepped down on the floor. My knees buckled like a marionette's with its strings severed. I staggered and toppled over with a thump. I lay limp like a broken doll. "Go easy on yourself." He lifted me and laid me on the desk. "What's wrong with me, Dr. Gunma?" "Don't worry," he said as he examined my feet one by one. He walked to the cabinet and pulled out a couple of leg braces. I recoiled at the sight. "These will fix you up," he smiled. "It won't hurt." He put them on me. I winced visibly against an imaginary pain, but his touch was surprisingly smoothing. "There you go. You can practice walking once you get your strength back." "Thank you, Dr. Gunma." "Well, you can stay here until you find a place to stay," he said. "Unfortunately, I couldn't recover your lost data. We need to get you a new name. How about Nozomi? It means hope in Japanese." I nodded. Hope is the only commodity you can afford when you're down. "Let's put your arm back." Dr. Gunma grabbed my listless arm off the desk. He put on a helmet and welded it back into place. Yellow sparks broke like miniature fireworks. A few weeks passed. I settled into my new life. "Dad?" I blurted out. He startled, and the lantern light bathed him in a soft yellow glow. The rest of the apartment was shrouded in darkness, but the night no longer scared me when I stepped into the workroom. I smelled his spicy aftershave as his deft hands played over his tools. "What is it, Nozomi?" The name fitted me like a tailor-made dress. "May I call you Dad?" I asked with hesitancy. "You just did, my dear." "You don't mind, do you?" "No, I'd be honored." He flashed me a warm smile. "Dad?" A soothing warmth surged through me. "What is it?" He smiled, humoring me. "Nothing. I just wanted to hear myself say it." "Another thing? May I give you a hug?" "I want to see how my arm works," I said, blushing. "Sure, we may not be rich, but hugs are free." We smiled and hugged. This is the oldest memory I have. A few months later, my leg braces came off, but I still limped, especially on rainy days. I appeared to be at least outwardly healed. 5 years later, I'm still here. My memory hasn't returned yet. Maybe it never will. But it doesn't matter. As far as I'm concerned, I was born when my dad brought me here and fixed me up. My life is an empty void before meeting him. Mr. Jiminy lies beside me as I practice my karate moves in front of the mirror. Yeah! With a thud, I punch the dummy's stomach, spin, and elbow its face. Yeah! As I move away, I land a sweep to its knee. Karate comes natural to me. I've taught myself by watching tutorials online. But Dad thinks I was born with natural athleticism. With a single strike, I demoralize any human opponent. Knock, knock, knock. Dad's voice comes through the closed door. Come in, Dad. How's my darling girl? Let me show you my move. Oh, not on me, he cries in mock fear, and we burst into laughter. Look what I've got for you. He unwraps his bundle and shows a blue karate gi. Oh my gosh, I gasp and cover my face with both hands. Is it for me? Oh, Dad, you shouldn't have. I'd be lying if I said I wasn't worried sick about you, he frowns. But I remember you're gifted. I tell myself my daughter has a special gift, and it's not my place to dictate how you use it. I trust your judgment. Thanks, Dad. I come up to him and give him a hug. Well, put it on. See if it fits you. I love the karate gi so much that I wear it all day. The twilight falls from the leaden sky. Outside the window, a light rain sizzles on the tin roof like bacon in a hot pan. Neon signs flicker on and off and bathe steel skyscrapers with pink, cobalt blue, and dark green. Giant billboards hawk everything from a vacation on Mars to cybernetic surgery. Luxuries out of reach of those living in the lower city. The world below the window is pure chaos. Like panicked ants, a multitude of humans, half-humans, and cyborgs sway back and forth through a maze of concrete streets. I venture out only under the cloak of night. Noises come from the workroom. The lights dim as drilling starts. Dad must be with a patient. I roll out of bed and join him inside. A male cyborg hunches over in a chair. A recent wound runs across his chest. His arm is severed. Frayed wires stick out and spit sparks. Hello, I greet the cyborg. He nods and grimaces. Dad, you need anything? Pass me a driver, Nozomi. I hand him a driver and I turn to the cyborg. If you don't mind me asking, what happened? Somebody tried to skin me alive, miss. His grimace deepens as Dad examines his wound. You can't go out alone at night. An organ thief? I mirror his grimace. Organ trafficking has become as common as a stray cat. The rich and powerful hire body snatchers to harvest organs in the lower city. Yeah, the well-to-do are loaded with dough because they steal everything we've got. The cyborg spits out, wearing a wry smile. The mayor's words are pure poison. Before he ran for office, he made millions by selling organs on the black market. He incites violence with his vitriol. Cops side with criminals, especially down below the lower city. If you get taken into the arena, you're as good as dead. They harvest your organs while you're still alive. After Dad goes to bed, I sneak out of our apartment. He knows what I'm up to, but I spare him the details. Fluorescent lights buzz in the hallway. I head to the elevator and hit the button. I walk along the labyrinth of dimly lit streets snaking through the lower city. An occasional street lamp affords me passing glimpses of my surroundings. A still Ferris wheel stands like a caged dinosaur in a museum. Shuttered stands rattle when the wind blows. I turn at a corner and enter a dark alley. I remove the cover and go down into a manhole. Another city lies underneath, strewn with streets, crossings, squares, and alleys. I hurry along. These underground streets reek with the stench of clogged sewers. Streetwalkers, both human and cybernetic, stand bathed in neon lights. Somebody screams for God in a dark alley. I squeeze past two drunken men staggering out of a bar. Here, those worse off than us in the lower city seek shelter. Yet this is the only place where the haves mingle with the have-nots, albeit while maintaining a safe distance. The rich from the upper city come here to watch gladiator fights. At a makeshift arena, they salivate at the sight of blood as cyborgs are pitted against each other. As I reach a clearing, a large circus tent comes into view. That's the arena. My heartbeat quickens. My hands become sweaty. I step inside. Tent ceiling liners hide poles and brackets supporting the tent. A raised ring covered with red canvas stands in the center. A rowdy crowd cheers on gladiators as they're about to bash each other to death. A trumpet signals the start of a match. I glance around and spot the mayor in his usual seat in the front row. His pale figure splashes across the jumbotron, replacing an ad-peddling sugary soda. The mayor sneers and whispers to the woman next to him. A cheetah growls at a cyborg and leaps at him. The cyborg raises his arm to shield himself, and the cheetah crashes against it. The animal leaps and bites the cyborg. It drags him to one corner and mauls him. The crowd screams and stomps, drowning out the cyborg's moans. The mayor looms around the jumbotron again. He raises his right hand, and the crowd turns to him. The mayor gives a thumbs down. On cue, a frenzied mob of thugs runs towards the ring, their exploding wrath threatening to unleash upon any target. A high-pitched scream pierces the ear. I dash toward the ring and climb into it. "Leave him alone," I yell. The thugs are too busy fighting amongst themselves to notice me. I glance toward the first row of the spectators. I spot the mayor, and our eyes meet. His gaze makes me shudder. "Who are you, little girl?" One of the thugs in dark glasses turns to me. He taps his palm with a baseball bat. He looks me up and down, sizing me up. "You don't scare me one bit. Not one bit." He snickers and steps closer. He takes a swing, and I shield the cyborg with my body. His bat strikes my arm with a dull thud. I grimace in pain. "Enough," I shout and glare at him. He takes another swing, and the bat grazes me. As I drag the cyborg away from the mob, he grabs me and twists my damaged arm. I wiggle away and take a swing at him. My fist catches on the side of his head, and he goes down on one knee. A swift shadow of surprise crosses his face as I smack him in the groin. He collapses and writhes in pain. I grab the cyborg's hand and help him to his feet. "Can you run?" I look into the cyborg's face. He nods and grimaces. The mob descends upon the punk. His dark glasses fly off his face and fall to the ground, and several feet step on them, making cracking sounds. His shrieks pierce the air. Maybe it's his bones that are being crushed. We dart towards the exit without turning back. "Dad, help us," I call out as we stagger inside. Mr. Jiminy gets up from his usual spot by the door and growls. "Well, what have you got there?" Dressed in his pajamas, Dad comes out of his room, slipping his arms into his robe's sleeves. He yawns, but then becomes alert when he sees us. We carry the cyborg's weight on our shoulders and drag him into the workroom. We sit him on the stool, and his body goes limp. "Dad, this is Hiroshi. Hiroshi, this is my dad, Dr. Gunma." Hiroshi nods weakly. Dad mimics his nodding. "You're hurt, Nozomi." I noticed for the first time a wound on my arm. "It's nothing, only a scratch." I smiled to assure him I'm okay. "Don't mind me. Dad, attend to him." I point to Hiroshi with my chin. Dad grabs the portable welder and steps forward. He looks at me, a frown on his brow, but then he nods again. Sparks fly from his tool, from Hiroshi's arm, and the familiar sounds of welding settle onto me like a mist. As I lean against a tool chest, my head begins to pound. Behind every blink, I see the mayor's schmarmy face, his sneer, the callous thumbs down. I saved one cyborg, but there will always be others. "Dad? What is it, Nozomi?" Dad asks as he dresses my wound. "When will this end?" I sigh. "The injustice." "We do what we can, darling." He smiles, and I can't help but smile back. "Pass me a driver, my dear." "Sure, Dad." I spring up, reach into the toolbox, and grab the tool. In this episode of Simultaneous Times, you heard Little Monsters by Cora Boulert, with music by Red, Blue, Black, Silver. Cora is the winner of the 2021 Space Cowboy Award. Congratulations, Cora. And you also heard Hidden Underneath by Toshiya Kamei, with music by Fog Machine. Theme music by Dane Luscombe. Be sure to check out our online store at bookshop.org/shop/spacecowboybooks. And don't forget to subscribe to Simultaneous Times Podcast. Also, find us on Instagram and Twitter. We'd love to hear what you think of the show.